During the season of Lent, we've been looking, starting last week, at the seven last sayings of Jesus from the cross. The first thing he said, actually on the cross, was, "Father, forgive them, for they don't know what they're doing." And we talked about how Jesus offers forgiveness even to his worst enemies. We applied that by saying, where do we have places of unforgiveness in our lives that we need to release and let go for ourselves and for the people around us? This week, we read that Jesus says, "Truly I tell you, today you will be with me in paradise." This is a pretty amazing thing that Jesus says from the cross. It's full of certainty about who he is and what he's about and what he's accomplishing in his death. It's full of compassion given out freely to anyone around him who will accept it. It's disturbing in that so few were willing to receive it. We live in a world that's very comfortable often giving compassion in one way or another, but is very uncomfortable when it's offered to us. When someone chooses to give us compassion, it's actually a way of saying, you are in need of something, and I want to be part of meeting that need. We'd prefer to be people who are never in need of anything, wouldn't we? We think it's great to serve others. We are uncomfortable when others volunteer to serve us. We think it's great to pray for others, but we often don't want to share what we need people to pray about for us. We even sometimes in our own lives don't maybe pray for ourselves at all, thinking it's a better thing to pray for everyone else, not realizing that pride is snuck in by the back door there. It said, well, I'm really okay. It's everyone else who needs help. And I think Jesus starts to poke at these places in our lives with this statement. And it's a statement of hope for someone in particular as well, a statement of redemption. And if we start taking it apart, I think there are three words or phrases that really stand out in this one sentence that Jesus offers. The first is, he says, today you will be with me in paradise. Now, he said it in part because there were events that were taking place on that particular day. Jesus knew that this was the last day of his life. He knew this was the last day of the life of the criminal before him who asked for mercy, who asked to be included in Jesus' kingdom when it came. And Jesus tells him his hopes are going to be met today, in his darkest hour. But not just that. See, Jesus is referring to something much, much bigger here. He says what God is going to do for you is not delayed. When you die, it's going to happen in a matter of hours. God is already going to be at work. He's already going to give you what he has promised. Now, this is significant. There are actually branches, there are actually beliefs within Christianity that say, well, when we die, what happens is we essentially are unconscious until Jesus comes back. And I love how these particular doctrines emphasize that the most important thing is that Jesus is coming back to make right the things that have gone wrong in our world. It's not that Jesus will escape all of us away from this world. It's that Jesus will return and make it right. He'll make it good. And it has all of these implications for how we ought to live today. It means that we ought to be careful with our planet because Jesus is coming back to restore it, not to destroy it. It means that we ought to be cognizant of the suffering that's in our world today because the future glory that's coming is coming to make right what's wrong. And so we ought to care about people who are hurting. It means that our own sufferings matter today. Jesus speaks into them. Today, God is going to be at work. Jesus here touches on what the Christian hope is for us when we die. Today, at that moment of death, whenever it would be, hopefully not today, but when it comes, we'll go to be with the Lord. What does that look like exactly? Because I mentioned that really the Christian hope is Jesus coming back, not us going to him. The Christian hope is always that God comes to us. It's, I think, outlined here in this passage in ways we might not have expected. Do you remember there are three groups of people, or maybe four, we can divide it up into, in, referenced in this passage, who respond to Jesus. First, there are the religious leaders who are jealous of Jesus, and they say, if he's really God's chosen one, if he, you know, he saved others, let him save himself. See, they respond with rejection. You are not bringing the kind of kingdom that we wanted from God, and so we reject you. We don't want anything to do with you. If God really loves you, let him save you. Then there are the Roman soldiers. So they put this titular up on the cross here with his crime on it. Remember, it says his crime was that he was the king of the Jews, which means he was a failed revolutionary. He had come to throw off the Roman rulers, and now the Romans were having the last laugh by hanging him on the cross. And they hung that crime above him, the king of the Jews. And so the soldiers mocked him as well and said, you thought you were stronger than Caesar? Well, you got what's coming to you. Because the cross wasn't just about killing people. It was about humiliating them in every way so that no one would follow them again. The revolution dies here. And then there were the regular people standing around. And they sneered at him. They said, he saved others, let him save himself if he is God's Messiah, the chosen one, echoing what their religious leaders had said. And finally, there was another criminal hanging next to Jesus. Most likely, he was a failed revolutionary as well, one way or another. And he said, aren't you the Messiah? Save yourself and us. Clearly, God doesn't love you if you're dying on a cross. All of these people could have come to Jesus, and yet none of them did. Jesus told a parable that is, I think, pretty famous, the parable of the lost sheep. You've probably heard it before. The idea is, imagine you've got a shepherd, and he has 100 sheep, and one of them wanders away. Jesus said, won't he leave the 99 to go and find the one? See, God's the one who comes after us, often in places where we don't expect it. And that's where we run into this last person, a criminal hanging on the cross next to Jesus. And he's changed his mind about Jesus for reasons that the text doesn't make clear. It doesn't say, you know, I was thinking about it, and really, you know, the fact that there is a creator makes more sense than that there is no creator. I see evidence of design in the universe. Clearly, there must be a God. You know, I saw the miracles. He doesn't say any of that. He's just dying next to Jesus, and something changes in his heart. Don't you fear God, he said, since you're under the same sentence, speaking to the criminal who was making fun of Jesus, and maybe to everyone else as well, anyone who would listen. We are punished justly. We're getting what our deeds deserve, but this man has done nothing wrong. Then he said, Jesus, remember me when you come into your kingdom. And Jesus says, truly, I tell you today, you will be with me in paradise. What do failed revolutionaries have to look forward to hanging on the cross, especially when they've come to terms with the fact that they're guilty? They belong there. It's a pretty spectacular sort of confession, isn't it? Can you think, how do we usually respond when somebody says to us, you know, you've done this thing that's wrong? We often respond a lot more like children than we wish we did, didn't we? Well, you did this. What does that have to do with anything, right? How does somebody else messing up excuse my messing up? How does that make it better? Is my goal in life just to be better than the people sitting next to me? That sounds kind of horrible, doesn't it? Oh, my goal in life is to become like Jesus. I hope. That's what I'd like to be. He is humanity as it was always intended to be. And so whether or not somebody else is good has nothing to do with whether or not I'm good. Doesn't save me. Jesus won't be like, oh, you're right. You are better than that person standing next to you. My bad. He's not going to have that conversation with us. And so he says, this is what I'll offer today to you if you want it. Today you'll be with me in paradise. Now, paradise probably evokes a lot of different images for us, right? You've been to Hawaii, paradise probably looks a lot like Hawaii. You've been, maybe you imagine a place where you can do certain things or be certain things or think certain things. Maybe you just think of an earth that's really nice and really good and where the bad stuff doesn't happen. But paradise in Jesus' day had a pretty specific sort of referent. See, first of all, this word paradise comes from ancient gardens that the fancy people would have, mostly the kings. Because, you know, out in the Middle East where these folks lived, I mean, water often didn't just fall from the sky, right? It wasn't like, well, maybe it was a lot like here, but it was, you know, water was something that was precious, and in order to have a fancy garden where you could go rest and relax, you had to be somebody pretty important. And so this idea of having a garden retreat, that was special. It was spectacular, a place where it was green and there were flowers and whatever else it was that you want. Do you remember one of the seven ancient wonders of the world? The Hanging Gardens of Babylon. That was the idea here, a place that was so wonderful that you would kind of separate it out and say there's not really much else in the world that's like this. But there was more going on too. Because do you remember where the story of the Bible begins? In a garden. In a garden. So there is this expectation that when we die, if God is pleased with us, we'll go to a place that's a lot like Eden while we wait for him to finish what he's doing in the world. We'll go to a place of rest where things are good. We'll go to a paradise. And Jesus offers that to this criminal hanging on the cross by him. I know who you are. I know what you've done. You've acknowledged that you belong on the cross. And yet you, today, are invited into paradise. One other phrase that we ought to look at before we take a bigger picture view. It's today, it's paradise, but it's also with me. With me. Not me, Jesus. Today, Jesus says, you will be with me in paradise. I came across somebody once who said, you know, someday when I die and I go to heaven, I think I'll be able to fly. We thought, oh, that's really interesting. Why do you think that? Because I've always wanted to. And you know what? Our desires, they're not bad. They can go wrong. So I don't want to criticize or pile on and be like, that's a stupid desire. There's this great movie my kids watch, Tangled. We watch only kids' movies these days. And there's a song called I Have a Dream. They're all telling about their dreams to be a concert pianist and to see the floating lanterns gleam. It rhymes with the other stuff in the song. And then this other guy says, I want an island all by myself with lots of money. And somebody says to him, your dream stinks. We don't always want the right things, do we? And so Jesus tells us, you want to know what paradise is like? Because sometimes you want the wrong things. Paradise is with me. I know he says this on purpose because in the book of Philippians, when Paul is wrestling with the fact that he may die very soon, he says this, to live is Christ, but to die is gain, because it means going on to be with Jesus. Do you have a best friend? I mean, it may be a friend, a brother, a sister, a spouse, something like this. Life is just better when you're with your best friend, isn't it? Colors are more vivid. You know, life is more fun. And Jesus is saying the thing that really makes paradise paradise is me. It's not the climate. You know, in summer, when it's 180 degrees outside, you can still be happy here, can't you? Especially when you're with the right people. In Michigan, in Chicago, where it's negative 30 degrees one day and then 30 degrees positive the next day because their weather is really insane, you can still be happy, can't you? Because it's not the things in life or the climate or the circumstances so much as the people that we share it with. So Jesus says, today, paradise with me. And who does he offer it to? We come back to this, although we've touched on it before. He offers it to someone who's not particularly likely, doesn't he? All the religious leaders have abandoned Jesus. All the people who should have known ran off. All the people who everyone else thought, you know, those are the holy, smart people. If anyone knows what God wants out of us, it's them. All of the powerful people rejected him. The Romans, right? They were the political power in the day. They said, you know, King of the Jews, yeah, right, dying on a cross. The regular people rejected him. And who was Jesus left with? He was left with a justly condemned criminal. And who is he pleased to say, today in paradise with me? When Paul writes to the church in Corinth, one of the things that he tells them is, consider who you were when God called you. Not many of you, he said, were people of importance and significance in your world. Some people might even say that you were the dregs. And yet, consider what God is making you. Consider the one who has called you. You know, I think one of the things this points out for us, I know it does for me, because I think, what kind of church do I want? What kind of church do I want to build as a pastor? First of all, it's not my job to build the church. It's God's job to build the church. My job is not to mess it up. But when I think of the people that I would fill the pews with, you know, I often don't think of, let me go looking for the least likely people, or at least in my estimation, my calculus. Let me find all of the poor. Let's fill up the church with all of the poor, because then we'll be people of significance and influence, right? Yeah. Tell me, all of our politicians, as we're gearing up for another presidential election cycle, are they complaining that the poor people have too much power? Or are they saying the wealthy are buying the elections? Yeah, not people of influence. Maybe we're thinking, hey, you know, who do we want to fill up the church with? Let's go find all the sick, right? Because then we'll have a thriving youth ministry if we have all the sick people in church. We think that way? No, of course not. It doesn't make any sense. Do we go around and think, let's go find all the people in prison? Because those are the folks with influence in our culture. We can build a big church with all of the people in prison. Who does Jesus choose? When Jesus pulls his disciples together, he finds the tax collectors. People didn't like him any better in the first century than they do today. When Jesus wanted to extend mercy to somebody, he found the criminal. He said, no one else is listening, but you are. And that's on purpose. God has planned this. He wants to make a church out of the cast-offs. And Paul tells us the reason why in Corinthians. He says, because then everyone will know God did it. When we have a people of influence who are made up of non-influential people, the only explanation will be that God is doing that. God is making a difference in that way. You know what I've often found? The people that I would choose to fill up the church don't want to come. The people I wouldn't choose on my own to fill up the church are dying to get in. So the question then is, why don't we invite them? Sometimes it's out of hatred. I don't like that person. I don't like those people. I don't like what they've done. I don't like the choices that they've made. I just don't like them. Sometimes it's cynicism. We say, well, you're so lost, no one can find you. No one can love you. Sometimes it's indifference. It's people that we pass by every day and we've taught ourselves to ignore them either because it's too hard to deal with their presence, or because we just can't be bothered.